Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions.
What does it mean to be American?
I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us for episode 25 of our series Democracy Optimist, hosted by University of Kentucky election and voting law research professor and author Joshua Douglas. This week, if ever there was a time for an emphasis on civics education, it's now.
Welcome to Democracy Optimist, where we discuss the current state of American democracy and even provide a dose of hope along the way. I have a bit of personal privilege as we start our conversation today. In May, my daughter was awarded the Kentucky Civic Seal at her 8th grade promotion ceremony. Her principal noted that the designation showed she had engaged meaningfully in projects that demonstrated the power of staying engaged in civic life. So what is the Kentucky Civic Seal? How do students obtain it? And why is it important? And could it be the key to improving civics education and ultimately sustaining our democracy? Here to tell us all about it is Carly Mutertes. Carly is a former high school social studies teacher, an expert in civic education, and the co-founder of Common Good Ed, an organization that seeks to provide educational resources to diverse communities. She is also the chair of the Kentucky Civic Education Coalition, which seeks to promote civic education in public schools. Carly, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Hi, great to be here.
So tell us about the Kentucky Civic Seal. Is this actually a big deal, or am I just being a proud dad?
It's a big deal. So the Kentucky Civic Seal is a recognition program to acknowledge students who practice exceptional citizenship. So we have four main criteria that students need to satisfy to be awarded it. They need to, first and foremost, the big component is they need to design and enact a civic engagement project of some form. It can be big or small, and it doesn't necessarily even need to be traditional politic topics. It can be about the issues facing students in their neighborhood. So students need to complete that project, design and complete it. They need to demonstrate knowledge of governance and democratic principles. They need to practice media and information literacy, which is particularly important in today's age. And they need to self-reflect. So it's not necessarily a big deal in that I believe this type of experience should be table stakes in modern education. But it is a big deal because giving students the opportunity to be the drivers of their learning and take action outside of the classroom is unfortunately the exception, not the rule.
So how did this start? I mean, it sounds like it cuts up against some of the focus of today's education, which is to teach to the test, to focus on math and reading skills and the scores. That's not obviously a negative. Those things are important, but this is an added thing on top of some of those, you know, major concerns that many teachers and parents and students have. So I guess there's a couple questions embedded in there. First, how did this initiative start? And how do you go and overcome those hurdles with the rest of the curriculum in schools?
Yeah. So how this initiative started really actually aligns well with that question, because the idea sprang from the passing of a civics test here in Kentucky. The legislature passed a graduation requirement where students need to pass a multiple choice exam modeled after the naturalization exam. And myself and some colleagues were in opposition to that. Not because we don't think that content knowledge is important, but because a multiple choice test does not demonstrate a student is prepared for engaging in their communities or applying what they learn in the classroom. So I actually went to the Capitol several times to speak against it. And a story I like to tell is that I believe I was in front of the school board when I said we really need an opportunity for students to experience and apply what they learn in the classroom, not just regurgitate content. Regurgitating content's good for trivia, but it's not good for preparing you for the real world. And one of the members of the board looked at me and said, "What you're asking us to do is hard." And he ended the sentence there. And of course, you know, anything worth doing is pretty hard, but there's examples all over the country of students being given this opportunity to, again, take what they're learning in the classroom, connect it to a real world issue, and then be given the opportunity to actually apply it. Now, going back to what you said about all the other considerations that teachers have, totally, 100%. With civics, though, that's where the magic really happens, because civics traditionally is associated with political science or government content, but it's really about how we apply what we learn to, again, those real world issues. So there's all kinds of studies that demonstrate when students have these experiences, it increases both academic and social outcomes. So it increases test scores across subject areas. It increases students' connection to school, to one another. It also builds their confidence in their ability to succeed at school. So while, you know, a lot of people might say civics is actually just social studies, it's about, you know, how a bill becomes a law, it's actually so much more than that when you frame it in the way that we're trying to do with the Civic Seal.
So I'm going to ask a follow-up question, which is probably going to sound super obvious to you, but I think worth exploring. You gave us a little bit about why improving civics education is important, but I want to go a little bit deeper. In today's political environment, in today's culture, why is it vital that we really invest in students' civic learning?
Oh, there's so much I could talk about with this. I know we don't have all day. Really, you know, one thing we can anchor on here is ultimately the idea of why do we even value public education in this country? And a lot of folks might say, well, it's preparing students for their future careers, preparing them for college, which is all legitimate and true. But ultimately, schools are a microcosm of greater society. This is the opportunity to prepare students not only for future careers, but giving them the opportunity to engage with diverse people. They've actually done studies that in students, you know, K-12 experiences, that's going to be the most diverse communities that they interact with. So civic learning is going to be beyond even the applying of knowledge in that it's also about what are we teaching students in the classroom about how they learn, about how they engage with one another, how they ask questions. So civic education, like I said, I feel like it is the magic where it allows students to see how what they learn is applicable to their lives. But it's also about just fostering students' understanding of how to live in a pluralist society, how to talk to one another. And that's something that is very obvious to say is a particular challenge for adults right now, let alone students.
Yeah, I'm curious about how Kentucky does on this front. A 2023 study found that only 44% of Kentuckians could name a legislator who represented them or had contacted an elected official. First, is that the right measure of civic engagement? You know, can you name your member of Congress or your state legislator? And second, how does Kentucky fare on measures of civic education and civic knowledge?
I think it's a measure. I don't know if there is one indicator that I would say this is how we know. But going back to even the civics test, that civic engagement, how we frame that, shouldn't be in just any individual acts that we associate with traditional civics. Voting, for example, is a really helpful metric, and it's indicative of other things, but that's not the only way we should be thinking about civic engagement. So I do think, like, knowing who your representatives are is important, but if students just have that memorized and don't know what that person does, then we really haven't changed our circumstances. And when I've spoken with legislators, that's their biggest complaint, is people call and don't know what it is they do. And if we give students the experiences to actually apply and, like you said, contact those elected representatives, they're going to learn it through that action versus just memorizing it, right? Now, in terms of how Kentucky is doing, in that kind of metric, we're on par with a lot of other places. And that's kind of like a perennial issue, right? Of civic knowledge, U.S. history knowledge. I feel like every generation or so, there's articles saying kids don't know anything these days, but you can find those articles going back to the 1800s, right? So that kind of metric, again, it's helpful, and I think that demonstrates that what we're doing hasn't been effective, but rather than double downing on memorizing content, how can we move towards approaches that we know work and we know engage students and have all these holistic benefits that make schooling relevant and meaningful to kiddos?
We're speaking with Carly Mutertes, one of the people behind the creation of the Kentucky Civic Seal, which students in Kentucky can obtain. So tell us more about how a student actually receives the Kentucky Civic Seal. How are teachers involved, parents involved, and the students themselves?
The program itself is meant to be flexible to students, to schools, to geographic contexts. So on our website, which is kycivicseal.org, we list some of the criteria based upon those four elements that I mentioned previously. But how that comes to life in the classroom will and should look different. So what I mean is, we had an elementary school here in Lexington, where I'm based, where her students identified issues of all sorts that they were interested in. They did research, they proposed action, they took action. So that wasn't necessarily even in a social studies class. And a lot of the topics students selected really were interdisciplinary. Like, there were topics about honeybees and how we can be more thoughtful about protecting honeybee habitats, which is very much a part of a science curriculum. Likewise, we have other schools who have other programs they're doing, other leadership programs like Model UN or similar. And if students are given the opportunity to drive that learning, then they are going to be eligible for the Civic Seal. So again, we have criteria, but ultimately we work with teachers all over the state and help them think about, how in my context can I give students an opportunity to apply what they learn? So we have it mainly in social studies classes right now, but I'm really hoping we see more and more bridging to the arts, to English language arts, to science, and even ancient history. There needs to be more opportunities to demonstrate why that information is meaningful.
And students can obtain the Civic Seal three times, actually, during their education, right? Because you can get it for elementary school up to fifth grade, middle school up to eighth, and then in high school as well, correct?
And that is correct. I'm not opposed to students earning it more than once in a particular grade band. That this type of experience, while we're acknowledging it through this program, we ultimately want this to be something habitually present in classrooms. And one thing I'll note, too, that makes Kentucky's program really special is, to the best of my knowledge, we are still the only program of this type that is available to elementary and middle school students. That civic engagement programs are often reserved for high school students. And elementary classrooms, I believe, are where the civic magic really lives, because that is a democratic space.
So these days, talking about improving civics education almost seems political itself. I mean, civic education has become kind of a dirty word or a dirty phrase among some people. How do we fight back against the idea that better education about democracy is somehow ideological?
I think what we're doing in Kentucky is a really strong demonstration of that for the nation, not just for folks within our state. Because as you said, a lot of civic engagement and a lot of language associated with civic engagement has been associated with partisan leanings. There's several terms that I just don't use when I'm talking with various people because I know there are partisan connotations. And not that I agree with those associations, but I recognize they exist. But what we're trying to demonstrate is everything is political, but not all engagement has to be partisan. So the civic engagement projects, I already gave at least one example, but when we talk to teachers, administrators, superintendents, we say these don't have to be hyper-partisan issues, because a lot of what those leaders are concerned about is their jobs, about getting angry phone calls, getting on the news for students participating in something that they would rather they not, right? But what we do is try to frame it as, this is where we're giving students opportunity to do something about something that they care about. And the media and information literacy component is also key to that, that we don't want students of any partisan slant to go into a topic already knowing their opinion and what they think should be done. That there is emphasis on weighing different perspectives and considering what they want to do in light of those. Now, we know not everyone will necessarily do that in earnest, but the idea is we're setting students up to do all the things that we want thoughtful citizens to do. But then ultimately, students are the drivers of this. Teachers can, you know, put up guardrails and make sure that they're doing things within the rules, but giving students that agency, it's going to get, you know, it can get into these partisan issues. But so far, what we've seen across the political aisle is folks really being inspired what students are coming up with. And to that point, too, it's also important to note that the Civic Seal, our partner in the Capitol, is the Secretary of State, who is himself a Republican and has been a super champion for this work. And I'm really proud that Kentucky was the first red state to have a civic seal, because I think we're really demonstrating that it doesn't always have to devolve into these partisan divides.
Now, of course, civic education should not just end in grade school. Tell us about some of the efforts to engage adults and make civic education a lifelong endeavor.
Yeah, and that's where it gets even trickier, right? They're not a captive audience once they're no longer in schools. One phenomenon that I think is really important to mention is that there has been a noted, what one person called, a trickle-up effect, where if students or young people are engaging in this way, that it has an influence on parents, on caretakers, on the community writ large. So like you said, we're talking about school, but in terms of like the long game, we're creating a foundation to really create more informed, engaged communities overall. So thinking about the adult experience right now, it's challenging depending on where you are. There's well-documented evidence about some communities, particularly rural communities, that are sometimes referred to as civic deserts, meaning the civic community ways people connect. There aren't as many options as, say, a big city where you can find people you relate to no matter what your interests are, right? But I do think for folks who want to engage, it's a matter of finding what resources there are in your region or connecting nationally because we have the technology to do that. And finding ways that you can engage, connect in ways that are authentic to you. Where I am in Lexington, I work really close with a lot of nonprofits here, not least of which being a group called Civic Lex, who I saw you interviewed the executive director in a previous episode.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of what their work is doing is building spaces for people to come together. And I think that's really key to all of the things we're talking about is returning to the importance of being in a pluralist democracy and creating room for that.
Carly Mutertes is a civic education champion and is the co-founder of Common Good Ed, which you can find at commongooded.com. You can learn more about the Kentucky Civic Seal program at kycivicseal.org. Carly, thanks for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thank you.
Josh, I know that you sit on the board of Civic Lex, the civics nonprofit here in Lexington that has really captured imaginations around the country. And we hear calls these days for a return to civic education in our schools. Was civic education ever a more regular part of the curriculum in public schools? What happened to change that, if it was?
I think we've always had some aspect of civic education in schools, but maybe not in the way that Carly was discussing we should in a more formalized manner. And I also think that we have shifted away from civics education in favor of math and reading. But one of the most important and interesting points that she made, I thought, was that civics education does not have to be a separate subject, right? It can be incorporated within math and reading and science. And she mentioned ancient history. So, you know, I think the work that Civic Lex is doing is really important in helping. They have a whole K through 12 program that they run as part of this, and they helped get some classrooms in Lexington to actually have the whole class get the Kentucky Civic Seal. But it needs to be a more holistic discussion as opposed to this is just your 45 minutes of civics education in the classroom.
You alluded during the interview to the idea that when people hear civics education, it's kind of a yawner. However, in a practical sense, in the day-to-day of living and working, raising a family in a community, why is it important to have true civic knowledge?
Because it's all about living in a society, right? I mean, you know, people drive on the roads. They care about schools. They care about clean water and clean air and public health. All of these subjects have at their core civic knowledge, right? Because who do you think paves those roads? Who do you think makes the policies that dictate whether you have drinking water that comes out of your faucets? And this is why I'm also so focused on local government, right? So many of these things come down to your local representatives. They actually impact your lives way more than the president does. You know, we have so much attention on the presidency, but it's your local representative that actually impacts your day-to-day living so much more. You know, everyone wants good schools. And so while civics can be a yawner, that word, or even can be politically charged, I mean, who can object to the core idea that we want good schools, that we want clean air and clean water and good roads to drive on? But those don't just happen magically. They don't just exist without people actually making important decisions about how our society should run. And so that's, I think, why civics really is an aspect of everyday life that we need to recognize.
Coming up after the break, talking civics over a warm plate of cookies. I'm Tom Martin. and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at weku.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top five stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin, and this week we're featuring episode 25 of our series Democracy Optimist, hosted by University of Kentucky election and voting law research professor and author Joshua Douglas.
Everyone likes warm cookies, and we all want a better democracy. Why not put those two ideas together? That's what the organization Warm Cookies of the Revolution does in Denver, Colorado. They recognize that people are busy. We work a lot. We take care of our families. Who has time for a public meeting that sounds boring and serious? Warm Cookies of the Revolution promotes civic health by creating an enjoyable and engaging atmosphere to discuss social issues that are critical to people's lives. And they bring warm cookies to every event. Here to discuss how it all works is Evan Weissman. Evan is the founder of Warm Cookies of the Revolution, which he refers to as a civic health club. He has won several awards for his efforts, which have engaged more than 1 million people. Evan, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Hey, thank you. I'm really excited to be here today with you.
So I guess even though this is, over the radio, I have to ask if you brought warm cookies to our conversation.
I'm currently eating them right now. Yes.
There we go. So why warm cookies? How did that all start?
Yeah. So we started it. I mean, if I'm being honest, the start was because I saw lots of people who did lots of things with their limited amount of time. For me, it was often in sports bars. I would have incredible conversations with just regular people, and they would go to places that were unexpected. We'd be watching a game, but that would bring up a lot of issues. And I realized, man, none of these people are at city council meetings or at budget meetings or at zoning meetings. And why is that? And the kind of light bulb there was people are busy and they spend their time and their money on what they care about. And if there's anything left over, they spend their time and their money on their necessary things. And if there's anything left over, then they spend it on what they like to do. And so I figured instead of trying to convince people to get involved in something that sounds horrible, what if we made interesting things that they wanted to attend, and then we kind of embedded it with civic issues? So that's kind of where it started, was let's make something fun. Let's make something that people actually want to do. And then there's an assumption, which is always right, which is that people care about the things that are closest to them, like their roads and their water and their kids' schools.
So you refer to this as a civic health organization. That kind of sounds like, you know, going to the gym for working out, but doing it for civic purposes. But what do you mean by that term? I mean, beyond having cookies at your events, how do you make it not feel like you're telling people to eat their vegetables?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So when we say civic health club, it's exactly that. It's like you go to the gym, you want to see results. You want to feel like your muscles are getting bigger and you want to see it. And we want to see that in our communities. You want to see things change if you want them to change. The way that we do it, yeah, we're pretty much the opposite of eat your vegetables. We take very seriously play and very seriously making things fun. So any time we approach any issue, any topic, whether that's something like housing or taxes, anything that we do that could be really, really boring, we, because all of us are artists, we come at it from a weird angle, from an angle of like, how can we get just a regular person involved in this? How can we make this sound as exciting as watching Netflix or going to an NFL game? And that's kind of our obsession. So everything that we do is specifically not eat your vegetables. It's let's do this fun thing. Eat these cookies. Eat these incredible cookies that you know you're going to want, both real and metaphorically. And then we kind of, like I said, we embed it with these civic issues and let people know, well, what can they do? What can I do to affect change or preserve what I love in my community?
And this is just a little aside, but I love the story about the cookies themselves. Tell us a little bit about, you know, how you get to having cookies at every event of yours.
Yeah. So, you know, once we started 13 years ago, and in the beginning, we, you know, a couple people maybe made some cookies, but we also bought them from some local places. And then a guy who had come, a volunteer, he said, hey, it's in your name. You got to have good cookies. And this is how I want to give back. So I'm going to bake cookies for you. And he has now for 13 years baked cookies for almost everything we've done. And this is hundreds and hundreds of different programs. He bakes classic cookies. He bakes vegan cookies and he bakes gluten-free cookies. And they're incredible. And you know, with interesting, they're not just all chocolate chip. They're, you know, like a chocolate red wine and olive oil, you know, blueberry cream. And he bakes them for everything. His name is Isaiah Busef. He would not want me to say his name on the radio, but I'm going to because he deserves the credit.
That's really cool. But this gives me, you know, looking at your website, which is really dynamic, it makes me think maybe, you know, Warm Cookies of the Revolution is just another liberal group trying to give liberals another space to make themselves feel better in the political environment. Am I wrong about that?
Yeah. Yeah. We, I'd say you are. We, this is an organization that is by and for people and run by artists and residents. And so this is for people who've been left behind. This is by and for people who have been ignored or kind of pushed to the margins. It is really, there isn't a political left or right to it outside of personal bias that, you know, I may have, and it may come into any programming, but we're in so many different places in rural, urban, and suburban areas. And we have so many different people involved that, no, this is like, you know, we have something called the Huddle for sports fans. That's for sports fans. We have stuff that's made by guys in, you know, lowrider car clubs. We do stuff with dancers. So we start with culture. And so who is involved is that's who it is. It's all those people who feel very left out by elections and by voting and by the kind of the one place where most people are told, hey, this is how you're a citizen. This is how you're civic, is by voting. And then maybe after that, like, you can write a letter to an elected official. So we're for all the people who feel like that is not either not enough or doesn't address their concerns, and specifically the 364 days out of the year that are not about voting and elections. And so that's a huge swath of people. And so it really isn't the liberal conservative thing at all.
As someone who's focused on voting rights so much in my career, I find it interesting that you're focused more on the time after Election Day. Why is that? Tell us about that approach. Also, throw in a little conversation about the election night dance party that you have and what comes after that.
Yeah. I mean, I think for most people, you know, even this idea of civic, it means very little to most people. You maybe took a class at some point and, you know, it has something to do with elections or voting or government or something. But what we're told is that it's about voting. And for most people, although there's a lot of people who can't vote just legally, then you have people who voted before and they saw no change and they're not even doing it. But for most issues, these things are actually very local, and you can actually have a big say on the things that to be civic means to feel ownership and to be a steward of the things that you own in your community, which is the water and the sidewalks and the jail and the library and the schools, etc. Like, we own all of these things, and you can affect change 364 days out of the year, other than voting day and then election day. You can get involved in many, many ways. But many of us are not taught that we can, or it's extremely difficult to go somewhere on a Tuesday at noon into a building that's a scary building, you know, that we've only been to because it's where we've gone to court. And it's not in our language, maybe, and we don't have childcare. There's a lot of barriers to entry. But if we can educate people about this, then people can find out how to get involved, and that actually you can make change in a really big way. So we focus on that because there is so much money and time and energy that is put towards voting. That's very important, and people do a good job with it, but there's very little put towards the other 364 days out of the year. And so the election night dance party, as you asked about, we've done that a few times, and it's essentially, we market it for months. We say, look, come to this party. It is after you voted, after the polls have closed. We're going to party. We're going to have a dance party. It's going to be a lot of fun because that's intense to get kind of spammed, text messaged, and have all these commercials at us for months and people telling us what we have to do. So let's celebrate that we did that. And let's also know that we're going to have to get to work the next day. And so one of the things we do is very simple. We have commitment cards, and we have a little fake USPS mailbox. And we tell people, here, write down what you commit to doing in your community in the first 100 days of this new administration. And we mail it to people a couple months later as a reminder of what they were thinking about at this really fun party. So our whole thing is, you vote every day. You can vote every day, and we will show you how, and we'll make it fun and joyous.
We're speaking with Evan Weissman, the founder of Warm Cookies of the Revolution in Denver, Colorado. You just mentioned the mantra, vote every day. You actually have a children's book, or kind of a book for adults that looks like a children's book, that is up on your website, and you can get physical copies of it. Tell us about that book, the origin of it, and how it all came about and what it is.
Yeah, we started with actually a different book first. Which was a lot more kind of artistic, and was it was photos and a poem. And that's one way to engage certain people. And we really enjoyed this children's book idea. So then we did the second one called Vote Every Day. And the idea, you know, these hard books that you read to babies, basically the concept there is, most people see them and their brains go, oh, this will take 30 seconds. And so we put them, we place them in DMVs and libraries and community centers in surprising places. And we have them translated into, 8 different languages. And then people can also buy them at pay what you want pricing. And what the idea behind it is, it's just getting across this notion that we do own our communities, that we need to show up whether we want to or not. If we want something to be a certain way, because the decisions are going to be made regardless. And it's a reminder. There's links in it, QR code links to people who have gotten together and really made some incredible headway and changes as kind of civic actors. And it shows that we have more power than we think we do when we get together. And we certainly have more power that we can see and taste and smell on an everyday basis than we do voting once a year, once every 4 years. So that's the idea. It's just, we get it to regular people's hands to remind them of this.
Now, you've spoken a lot about art and culture. You talked about the poem that turned into a book. You talked about a dance party. Why is art and culture so important to your approach to being a civic health club?
In a very practical way, pretty much any organization that I've ever seen around the country that has the word civic in it, for the most part, they're probably doing incredible work and they're probably writing interesting things, but they're often not actually engaged with regular people. Like, that is a nerdy sounding word, and it is often not connected to regular people's lives. And so what is, like I mentioned earlier, where we put our time. And so culture is how we pass the seasons, the foods that we use to celebrate. These are the things that are really important in our lives, and it's the thing that people really connect with. Art is a way of seeing things in a way that you maybe wouldn't have before. But for the most part, these are the things that are fun. These are the things that are interesting to us. And these are the things that if you ask most people what you've done in the past year, have you been to a music show? Have you gone shopping? Have you been to a church? Have you gone to a sporting event? These types of questions, most people say yes to. Have you been to a zoning meeting? Have you been to a water quality meeting? Have you been to a school board meeting? Most people would say no. And so we use art and culture to get people to then say, hey, here are ways that you can be involved, because everyone cares about that stuff. So it's important also, the other reason I'd say is we're not going to get to the future that we want if we don't have spaces to envision it. And if we don't have places where we can gather with other people who we either agree with or disagree with to say, what do we want for this community? What could it be? And how do we overcome these barriers, these very real challenges that we have? You're not going to do that unless you can envision it and work with other people to do it.
Tell us one of your favorite success stories, or maybe one of the projects that Warm Cookies has seen to fruition and demonstrated, hey, this model actually works.
The best success story that we have, outside of a lot of anecdotal stories that are really incredible, is we had a group of residents in Denver who very much wanted something called participatory budgeting. Now, this is the most boring sounding thing you could imagine. Participatory budgeting. Just, you almost are asleep when I say those words. But at its best, it can be very revolutionary. It's essentially where neighbors and neighborhoods decide a portion of the city budget. And so we had residents who wanted to do it. We had a mayor who did not want to do it and city council who did not want to do it. So we organized in very creative ways using some essentially sculptures almost that were in suitcases, one of which was a Rube Goldberg machine that sort of showed people like, hey, this is how you're usually engaged with the government. You kind of put something in and then it does all these crazy things. The chicken lays the egg and hits this and hits that, until what we would do is print out a piece of paper that said, thank you for your comments and concerns. That's how most people feel about those processes. And then the second one that we have would show people what a participatory budgeting system would look like. They would have control over it. It would be fun. They would need expert help as well. And so it was a physical, artistic, creative way of getting people to understand this process. And then we trained city staff to show them, hey, this process is going to make your life easier as well. And then we were training lots of residents. And then the last thing was, we needed to get more people to know about it. And we got a lot of press by creating, for a few weeks, we had an installation in a two-story garage that was wild. I mean, it was absolutely wild. And so we got all this news coverage. We could not be ignored. And ultimately, this was after a couple of years of pushing, we were successful. And the city of Denver adopted participatory budgeting. It's now starting its third round. And they also hired our residents to do community engagement. And that's been the biggest success in their program, is who's involved. It's the people who are not typical civic decision makers. It's many people who are poor, many people who are, the ages are even different because the community set it up. So you have young people, you have people in the county jail who are voting. It's a very different system, and it's been very successful.
So how can people in other parts of the country use the Warm Cookies model? I know, you know, where I am in Kentucky, we've got the organization Civic Lex, which we've talked a lot about on this show. I know you know them. People listening anywhere else, how can they use the same model to start something similar in their own communities?
Yeah, this is something, you know, we're in the process. It's been 13 years and we're finally getting around to responding to that question in a better way than we had, which people would often contact us and be like, this is cool, how can I do it? And we were like, I don't know. We're not Chipotle. We don't know how to do that. But right now we're in the process of creating basically toolkits and kind of an online space where people can trade and swap approaches. But we have over 40 different programs that can be replicated And so people are welcome to try to, you know, take what we have or talk with us and start kind of their own civic health club if they're interested. But even if it's not in that big of a way, I think if people gather with their neighbors and get together essentially with the mindset of how do I experiment the same way that chefs do with their ingredients or scientists do with their beakers and chemicals, how can I do that with my neighbors? How can we experiment with what it would look like if we control decision-making in our communities? And how can we get more people involved? So whatever the fun, interesting culture that you live around that gets people out, do that and bring them in. And don't do it in a sneaky way. Be real clear about it. And I think people will love to rise to that occasion.
Now, you strike me as someone who's particularly optimistic about the power of local engagement and about democracy in general. Of course, this is a show called Democracy Optimist. What makes you so optimistic?
I might take one quibble with that word, and this is my own little thing, is that I'm not as much someone who thinks about optimism and pessimism, because I think of those words as they leave out me. They leave out action, where I usually use hope or fear, but this is just a tiny little thing. But I think of like, I'm hopeful based on what we have the possibility to do. I think when people do get together, I could go on for hours of stories of people who see an issue, a problem, and they just start to solve it and they start to grab other people and they're able to make change. And I essentially, that's kind of the only way that I've seen most change that has expanded democracy, that has made this a more just country, has happened because groups of people get together with usually bold ideas to very real challenges, and they're able to make it happen and make it work. And so I'm inspired by people all over the place who do just that. And I think if that continues, it doesn't stop. And I think that when people make that mind shift to think of themselves as civic and as owners of their community, you never unlearn it. And it's actually where my greatest hope is for this country right now, is that I think people are waking up and understanding that locally, you can get someone to be civically engaged and they will, of course, they will vote. Of course, they will contact their legislators. They will do everything that voting in elections-based people want them to. But we can do it faster, we can do it cheaper, and we can do it for a more engaged time if we focus on civically engaging people locally. So I'm very, very hopeful that we'll do it. And I think if we can get more resources into the hands of people who are working locally, I think you're going to see changes much more significant than you would in doing electoral and voting work.
And of course, you're doing it over a plate of cookies. Evan Weissman is the founder of Warm Cookies of the Revolution, which you can find at warmcookiesoftherevolution.org. Evan, thank you so much for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Josh, warm cookies plus a better democracy. It sounds good, but maybe a little kumbaya. But it sounded to us as though this is really all about civic engagement. Is that correct?
I think that's right. But the framing here is really important, right? He talks about the organization Warm Cookies of the Revolution as a civic health club, right? I mentioned during our conversation, it sounded like gym membership. And he really bought into that as saying, yes, you know, you go to the gym to work out and you expect to see results in your health. And he sees that in the same way with a civic health organization. And also similarly, most of us who go to a gym, you know, we don't dread it. It's fun. It's part of our regular routine. And he wants to make that part of the regular routine as well for civic engagement. So I love this organization because I think it's so interesting how he's trying to make, you know, that word, we even, as he said, the word civic, that sounds boring, but make it really fun and really engaging.
University of Kentucky election and voting law research professor and author Joshua Douglas. Previous episodes of Democracy Optimist have talked about getting involved in what's happening in your community. That can mean a lot of things, from going to city council meetings and voicing your views to signing up for shared interest groups, such as those offered by a program at the University of Kentucky. Joey Conrad is here to talk about OLLI, the University of Kentucky's Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. Welcome, Joey.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Tell us about the mission of OLLI.
The mission of the OLLI at UK program is really to engage the minds, elevate the spirits, and enrich the lives of adults that are 50 and above through educational, social, and community activities. And we offer courses, socials, travel, and other lectures and opportunities that really are focused on engaging our community in peer-to-peer learning.
It's interesting, when you do reach your senior years, you find that you are ready to begin learning again. Is that a general thought behind the creation of OLLI?
This really came about because once we enter that next stage of our lives, it's kind of like, what do we do? What are our passions? How do we rediscover some of those things that we maybe had to put to the side because of our careers or just learn something new? And so this really offers an opportunity for people to engage in a fun way to learn, as well as create new social connections, because we understand that work for a lot of us becomes those social connections. And when we leave the workforce, we can really isolate ourselves. And so this really helps not only reinvigorate some of those passions and new learning opportunities, but really fosters new social connections as well.
And so these are courses, they're forums, shared interest groups, trips, and even events.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, so we really try to offer a wide variety of learning opportunities. We're always trying to expand those opportunities as well. And so we've even started implementing some of our virtual learning opportunities as well as our in-person. So that's kind of the full gambit of what we offer.
And these take place all around town, right?
Yeah, that's very correct. We really try to make them very accessible. We understand while we are a program of the University of Kentucky, most of our members are out in the community. And so we want to make sure that there's very accessible parking. They're easy to get to, easy to find, and conducive for those learning opportunities.
And is it a year-round program?
It is. So our membership starts every August 1st of the year and is good through July 31st of the next year. And that's a $50 membership fee and covers you for the fall, spring, and summer semesters.
How would somebody sign up for that?
You would just contact our office. Our registrar is Trey Adkins, and he would walk you through. It's a pretty simple form just to make sure you're eligible for the program. And then we would walk you through the steps of applying to the university.
All right, that's Joey Conrad with the University of Kentucky's Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, also known as OLLI. Thanks so much, Joey.
Thank you so much.
To be American. Home of the free.
Thanks for joining us for Democracy Optimist, a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions and WEKU. Joshua Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm your series producer, Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Eli Raymond, research assistant, Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at democracyoptimist.com, and podcast versions are available on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to get in touch? Our email is democracyoptimist@gmail.com. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Democracy Optimist from Eastern Standard and WEKU.